A radioactive production. Today we're here with Dennis Perrone, and this program will focus on the views of Dennis Perrone and how they differ of those of the four candidates for governor. One of the first questions that we want to get to is the other four leading candidates support capital punishment as a way to deter crime. How do you feel about the death penalty?
Well, I'm totally against the death penalty. It comes from my childhood that I was always taught that it was wrong to kill people, kill things. And besides that, when I was watching the trial of Timothy McVeigh and what he did to Oklahoma City, the recurring theme kept popping in my mind. Why did this guy do this? And the answer kept coming back that he killed people because we kill people. That is, our government killed babies at Waco, so that it was justified for him to kill people in Oklahoma City. And it becomes like killing begets killing, and we've become this society that's just vengeful and seeking revenge rather than justice. And I think it's a bad message to send to our youth, that it's all right to kill. And plus, I'm morally opposed to it. I don't feel like it deters crime. It's used against minorities more than it's used against white people. And I think it's bad social policy, and it's a bad message to our children.
The war on drugs. What are your feelings about the war on drugs?
Well, it's never really been a war on drugs. It's always been kind of a war on people. And it's a war on people that they don't like, essentially. And they're using this to get the people they don't like. If we talk about drugs in our society, we have drugs and drugs and drugs. And, of course, the legal ones are responsible for all the deaths. But the illegal ones are responsible for all the chaos in our society. They're responsible for drive-by shootings and drug dealers seen as role models. It's responsible for the AIDS virus being spread. It's responsible for destroying the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and eroding our civil liberties. No one's ever going to say, I want people on cocaine or I want people on crack or heroin. That's not good social policy. But what are we going to do for those people that are on those drugs? Our answer now is to lock them up for 15, 20 years, $25,000 a year, a wasted life. And because of this person having a drug habit that we don't approve of. Now, I'm all for treatment. I believe that we've got to treat people that want to get off these terrible drugs. At the same time, I'm for prescriptive access for hard drugs that we're going to put it back, if I'm elected governor, into the hands of doctors instead of cops and politicians who would use these people to divide and conquer. We're going to eliminate crime from this manner, and number one, we're going to save a lot of money. Number two, we're going to be morally stronger as a people, and we can end this low-level race war that's revolving around this war on drugs. We think it's a war on drugs, but it's kind of a metaphor for a war on the people we don't like. But who are these people? They are people of color. They are counterculture people. They are people that maybe wear their hair different or wear different clothes. We're essentially at war with people for what they look like. And it's wrong. And prohibition has never worked. And the war on drugs has got to end. But a little story is, I was talking to a junkie the other day. I mean, the guy was strung out on heroin. He was 23 years old, told me that he was had a $200 a day habit. And I says, $200 a day? Where do you get all this money? You don't have a job or anything. He goes, I rob stuff. He goes, I break into cars. I go to stores and shoplift. And he says, essentially, I'm shoplifting and robbing $400 worth of stuff a day to feed my $200 a day habit. And I'm thinking, this guy is a mini crime wave. And when you calculate that out, that we maybe have 100,000 heroin users in the state of California, you have got a crime wave going on, And essentially, they're using this $200 to buy 10 cents worth of heroin to treat an addiction that you could blame them for having it. But many people start these drugs because marijuana is not available, they're in serious pain, or they start it through no fault of their own. And essentially what we're doing is blaming these people for a terrible habit and condemning society to having your car broken into, your television robbed, and we're creating this crime. And if I'm elected governor, that will stop.
What is the correlation between the prisons and the war on drugs?
Well, an interesting sidebar to the war on drugs is kind of the war on Prop 215, where we had the narcs against us and the Police Chiefs Association, and all these people giving money. But then it was a surprising guy that gave money, and we gave $25,000 to the No on 215. It's the guy that supplies the plastic forks for the prisons. And I looked at that and I'm thinking, why does this guy feel so compelled to give $25,000 to an initiative that's about sick and dying people using marijuana? That who was he pressured by to do this? And of course, you know, the answer would come back, the California Narcotics Association, who have a vested interest in this whole war on drugs. Essentially, it's a jobs program. A jobs program for a bunch of cops, a bunch of jailers, a bunch of probation officers, social workers, and this drug program on the surface cost, you know, $20 billion a year on the federal level. But when you start getting down to the state level and you start counting all the things that it's going, that goes to this war on drugs, you're getting into the tune of $50 to $60 billion for the war on drugs. And you look at the prison population now, and now they're saying 80% of the people in prison are in there for some kind of drug-related crime, like the junkie I was talking about, the $200 a day habit, got caught breaking into a car, got 2 years in prison. 80% of the people in prison are this way. And now here we are using all our money to build more prisons, and this is kind of a self-perpetuating industry now. When the guy with the selling plastic spoons feels compelled to continue the war on drugs, we have a vested interest coming from all aspects of society to continue this war. It's becoming like an economic machine that is self-perpetuating and self-feeding, and is also self-defeating. In the big, big picture, we cannot remain at war with people in our society. In another country, it would be called a civil war. Here, we call it a war on drugs, but it's really a war on people. And it's really a war on minorities. And we might as well just call it what it is. If I'm elected governor, I'm going to end the war on drugs and reduce the prison population and use that money that we're going to save to start building houses and start building people up. And we are going to stop the scourge of hard drugs in our society within one generation. We will no longer have heroin addicts in the United States. Within one generation, cocaine and crack will be a distant memory. The faster we start, the better off we are.
What other forms of corporate welfare do you see?
Well, you know, on the surface, everyone can identify with the blackmail that's going on with baseball associations and how they want special deals to build their stadium in Yorktown. That's something that people can see. And some people, a lot of people support that. And they go, oh, yes, well, let's give this baseball team free land. Or let's give them a good sweetheart deal. That's stuff that's kind of a corporate welfare program for a giant business that wants something from the public for free, that says they're giving them back something while they take their money. Now, that happens that people can relate to that, but it happens almost every day on a corporate level, too. The corporations vie for communities. They say, well, I want to be in your town, but I don't like your tax structure. And counties and towns go out of their way to accommodate these people in the sake of jobs. There used to be a time when corporations paid their fair share of taxes, and that there was a time where they paid almost 27% of the total. and it's down now to 7% of the total. And they're not paying their fair share anymore. They're reaping the benefits of cheap labor, open markets, yet they refuse to pay their fair share by hiding their money. Under Perón administration, that will end. No more hiding your money in the Cayman Islands. If you're going to do business in California, you're going to pay your fair share of taxes. And no more giveaways, asking for giveaways from the communities. We're all in this state together. If a plant goes in Pleasant Hill or Milpitas, it's still in the state of California. People still commute. We have freedom of movement, that we don't have to go for this corporate blackmail that they're doing with us.
As the Mexican border becomes more militarized, what are your views on that?
Well, I've become so mad at these propositions that are seeking to demonize Mexican-American people and fan the fires of racism. I was against them. The people approved them. But I believe that they approved them because there's something deeper happening in our society, and that we've become a society of blaming people. And when anything goes wrong, we want to look for someone to blame. And, of course, now we're blaming Mexican-American people for our misgivings and our failures in the school system. And I believe, number one, the war on drugs is feeding the fires of this racist campaign. But it also is something to do with that border. I went down there recently, and when I went down there, I was so surprised because I felt like I was in Vietnam again. And what I saw down there was camouflaged military men, military trucks, people with M16s slung over their arms. And I was there at night, and there was searchlights scouring the hills and helicopters hovering overhead. And if you had closed your eyes and just heard the sounds, you would swear that you were in a war zone. And I got to thinking to myself, I said, are we at war with Mexico? What is happening at this border? Why is all this going on? What are they trying to keep away? They say it's drugs, but you know it's not. They've invented a term called illegal person, illegal alien, as if a person can be illegal. If people come to the United States to seek a better life, much like my grandfather came in 1918, people from Mexico come to America to get work. They don't want to stay in America. They don't want to be Americans. Many of them just want to get a job, get a little money, take that money home. This border is stopping people from going home. It's working two ways. It's stopping people that we need to work in the state of California from coming in. And then when they get through, and it's a joke, they get through, they can't get back. And so we're creating a bigger problem. And in the process, we're demonizing Mexican-American people. We're not so much in the north, but if you go down to Southern California, you're a Mexican-American. You're going to be pulled over at least once a week, either by the cops, INS, Border Patrol agents. Everyone's going to be asking for your green card, your identification. They're going to treat you like you're some kind of a criminal. And all because you have brown skin. And it is feeding the fires of racism. And I think it's a bad idea. I think Canada and Mexico and America share a common destiny. And I believe this borders are just keeping us from that common destiny. And it would not serve America well to have 120 million starving, desperate people on its borders. That we have got to improve the life of Mexicans and to make it desirable for them to stay in Mexico. Yet when we need their workers, and we need them, for them to come in this country, help us harvest our produce, and then if they want to go home.
What is the use of medical marijuana?
You know, I take a lot of hits because I say all marijuana use is medical. And I've not come to this conclusion lightly or easily. It has taken a 26-year experience with marijuana to see that it really is a medicine. And I know we talk about the munchies and the wasting syndrome and nausea and chemotherapy, and those are all valid. Marijuana helps multiple sclerosis patients and eases interocular pressure with glaucoma. But something deeper is in this drug that allows people to relax. It makes people feel better. And, you know, we have like 5 million people right now on Prozac or Elavil, they are not doing this recreationally. They are using these drugs to feel better because for some reason or another, they are depressed in their life. We as a society have acknowledged that you don't have to feel miserable, that we have a drug that make you feel better. Well, marijuana also fits into that category of making people feel better. And I come from a time before Prozac where depressed people were many of them killed themselves, many of them were put in psychiatric hospitals. We don't know how to deal with mental illness. Marijuana helps people relieve depression. And for that reason, it is one of the safer antidepressants on the market. That is, we know the side effects. The side effects, you get the munchies, you get a little spaced out, a little short-term memory. But we can live with that. And the consequences of Prozac or Elavil are not very clear because it's not been around very long. And I totally support it. If it works for people, I'm totally for it. At the same time, 30 years down the line, we might find out Prozac, causes brain damage. Marijuana has been around for thousands of years. Not one person has ever died from it. And they found it in the tomb of the pharaohs. I assure you that these pharaohs were not using marijuana recreationally. There is really no such thing as recreational marijuana. They have used that tag to essentially put us in jail. They're using it recreationally, therefore they should go to jail. And I don't buy that. I believe all marijuana use is medical.
Could you describe for us a world without guns, of which you've spoken?
From my experiences in Vietnam and my experiences in America, I know guns are for one thing and one thing only. They are for killing people or killing things. And that is wrong. It is wrong to kill. I believe we can have a world without guns. I believe that we can have a world without guns by eliminating the reasons that people have guns. And, I thought about this, and I wonder why people do have guns. And I've come to the conclusion that they have guns either because they fear crime or they fear the government. Now, if we could possibly do something about those things, maybe people would feel not so compelled to have guns in their night chest, in their night drawer, where their kids can find them. Have a gun around the house where someone breaking in the house could find them. I intend to do something about the crime problem by ending the drug war. We're going to eliminate 80% of the crime. I'm going to also bring back trust to government. And we have people in our country who don't trust our government and who thinks that our government is against them. Now, this was supposed to be a government by the people and for the people. How can we distrust our own government? Well, I'm going to bring back trust to government. I'm going to use the police's forces to create peace and not war on its people. And that after my administration is over, you will not fear the police. You will not fear the government. That's not going to happen anymore. The war on drugs is over. The war on people are over. The government is there to help you and only help you. Help you make a better life for you and your family. When I'm elected governor, that is what's going to happen.
Could you explain to us a little bit about your relationship with Harvey Milk?
Well, I like to consider Harvey Milk my mentor. He taught me that you can do the impossible in America. You can get a seat at the dinner table if you demand it and you make enough noise. Harvey Milk was the first out front gay person elected to anything in America. And it was a symbol of hope for people that have been pushed aside their whole life, that gay people have been hated universally in every country, every society, forever. And they never have found a place at the table in any country or any time in history. And this is it was a dawning of a new age where everybody was a part of America, and that everybody could have a say in the future. And as a gay man, he gave me hope that someday I also could have a say in America. And I think he gave all the people that have been pushed out of America, including every minority, that there was hope for America, and that it was about empowerment, that if we took the power of our vote, that we could change the course of destiny. And Harvey Milk, although died so young and so fast, left a legacy that a lot of people still live up to, and I do too. And it was one of love and inclusion. And I like to think that I'm carrying on his work of bringing people in, into the American process, and making them feel part of America.
As governor, what's your position on the old growth redwoods and the headwaters forest issue?
Well, you know, I'm running for governor, and you know, I got to admit, I'm a common man. I'm not sure really even the power of the governor. I had to research it all, and I don't know, they can veto bills, and they can sponsor bills and all that. But I also found out they have the power of eminent domain. And eminent domain has always been used to get, for the government to seize people's houses if they want to put a road there, to take people's land if it serves like the county good or the state good. I'm going to use that power for goodness. I'm going to use that power to create open spaces. I'm also going to use that power to seize the Headwaters National Forest, the Headwaters Rainforest, and pay Mr. Horace a dollar for that land and keep that land in perpetuity, rename it after Judy Berry, and it'll be called, we call the Judy Berry Watershed National Forest, State Forest, and for perpetuity, those plant, those old growth trees will remain forever. So I'm going to use that power of eminent domain. I also have a plan to build the cities. Every time I drive anywhere in California, every time I haven't been to a place in 6 months, I go back and there's houses along the hills and giant subdivisions. And I counted the houses once, and there was 250 houses on this giant piece of land. I mean, giant, giant piece of land. And I calculated there's 750 people living on all this land that once was a meadow and a hill. And I think, why do these people want to live here? Why did they move out of the cities? They're moving out of the cities because we gave up on the cities. That we're making it easy for these people to build urban sprawl and to build these giant houses that are empty most of the time. And then, you know, even the people that are living in them aren't very happy. That they're dependent on one or two cars. They have no sense of community. They have no sense of being and place. They've all just moved in there in the last 6 months, and they don't even know why they're there. Besides the big old beautiful house, there's a lot of loneliness in all these houses. And I want to bring people together. I have a plan to build the cities and make them paradise on earth. I plan on building bicycle paths and non-polluting vehicles and alternative transportation. I want to bring people back to the cities, and for all the reasons that they want to be in cities, because we want to be together. And we're going to build parks and build up all the reasons that people want to live in the cities. And this is where we can stop the urban growth and maybe preserve some open space so that we will not be the last generation that knows that there was once hills dotted with green trees, without houses, without roads, without 750 people living on a giant tract when they could have been living on one block in Los Angeles.
Is this what you mean by California with a heart?
When I say California with a heart, most people view government as the enemy. I have three slogans. I have hope, empowerment, and compassion. I talk about the empowerment that everybody has given up. You have an election and 60% of the people don't show up. And we had an election in California where 27% of the people showed up. Now, what does that say about democracy? How can we run a country with only 27% of it caring what's happening? That what happened to these people? Why do they feel so disempowered? Why do they feel that no one represents them? I want to bring back hope to govern, to the people. I want to give them a reason to feel part of America. And my candidacy is about empowerment. It's about having a candidate that represents you, that represents your dreams, I don't know if I'm 51% of the vote. But, you know, people told me Prop 215 wasn't going to win. They said it doesn't have a chance. And yet we won by 56%, you know, which is called a landslide. I believe that my candidacy, whether I win or not, is a victory for the people and a victory for democracy. And I talk about California with a heart, that if I get elected, I will run the government from my heart, as well as my brain, but I will make the right choices. And in the end, we're all going to like each other a lot more.
What are some of the things we should know about the primary coming up in June 2nd?
Well, because it's an open primary, that means you vote for the candidate of your choice, which is the way it should always be. If you vote for a party, I mean, essentially what you're saying, you think you're going to get a bill of goods that you never get anyway. I mean, you vote for a Democrat, you think you're voting for a liberal person that has a kind heart and a social program. Yet some of these Democrats are worse than the Republicans, and they're promising more jails and more prisons, and some of them don't even want to take stands on the issues. Republican Party, like anything, is what you make it. And it started out as a good idea that everyone should be free, and Abe Lincoln had that idea, and he was a Republican. And William Weld is a Republican. That is, he believes in social programs, and he's a very liberal on human rights issues, which is what I am. At the same time, I think government has got so big that it's forgotten who it served. I believe in small government. I believe we're paying too many taxes and not getting anything for it. I believe if we eliminate some of the meanness in government, we could pay less taxes. We can be more happy with our government. So that's what I mean by a kinder government.
Would you care to comment on your opponent, Dan Lundgren, and his 26% pay raise as Attorney General?
He has done everything he could to stomp out the will of the people and stomp on democracy, and essentially has made his whole life out of hate and division, and his whole political career. I told you my mentor was Harvey Milk. His mentor was Richard Nixon. It feels like Richard Nixon is alive in Dan Lundgren's body. Besides him getting this big raise, which really didn't, I can't blame him for that, because it came from a commission that said he should get a raise. And I don't believe he deserves that. I don't believe any of those guys deserve it. I think they're already making too much money. I believe the smaller people who haven't gotten a raise in 5 years, the state workers, are more deserving of that raise than Dan Lundgren and Pete Wilson. I don't blame him for that raise, but I do blame him for his mean-spiritedness, for his continuing campaign of division and hate. I do know that Dan Lundgren and his ilk will someday be in the garbage can of history. All the guy has to do is open his mouth, and people see who that guy is. For that reason, I've learned to love all my enemies. I have an old woman that works for me. Her name is Hazel Rogers. She's now the director of the club. But she told me a long time ago to love my enemies. And I said to her, Hazel, how am I going to love my enemies? It's hard enough loving my friends. But she told me that I will never win this unless I love my enemies. And now, in the last couple of years, I've learned to see the wisdom of her that she had. Because now I love Dan Lundgren. And by loving him, I see clearly who he is. And it has also taken a big burden off me, because hating somebody is so much work. I love that man because he says who he is and he lets people know who he is. And for that, I'm glad, because at least people will reject him and will be free to reject him. And for that also, I'm a better person and I don't have to put anybody down.
You were involved in the Vietnam War. Maybe you could explain a little bit about your participation there.
Well, I'm not really proud of my experiences in Vietnam. It took me a long time coming back from the war to forgive myself for being a part of that terrible war and inflicting such pain on the Vietnamese people. It started for me when I was drafted at 18, and I said, well, if I join the Air Force and skew the Army, maybe I won't go to Vietnam. Within a year of that, I was in Vietnam. And 4 months later, I was caught up in the Tet Offensive, where the North Vietnamese took over the city of Saigon, and I was on the base in Tan Son Nhut, the air base. And I was taken from my job in the mailroom and assigned to the morgue. And it was my first time ever seeing a dead person. And I had just come out of my closet as a gay man. And my job was to put men into body bags and into aluminum caskets to ship back to the United States. And I got to the morgue, and as far as the eye could see, there were dead people. Some of them were bloated and blue. And it was the first time I've ever seen a dead person. And I was forced to put these people into body bags, wrecked bodies, blown apart. And it was that point in my life that I dedicated my life to world peace, that I would never, that I would always work, that some young man like myself would never have to put another young man into a body bag to ship him back home. And you might say it was an epiphany in my life, but I have never given up that vow. I am still working for world peace. Having known war so intimately, I know that I must be a messenger of peace, that it has to come from a person that knows war to know peace.
Are there any other comments that you would like to make to the people out there listening?
Well, you know, I say I have three words that I'm running for, and I told you about empowerment. I got that word from Martin Luther King, who showed America that we can take control of this government and the control of this country, and that we have power in this country, and it's the power to vote. And I got the word hope from my friend Harvey Milk, who told me that people cannot live without hope, and that they give up if they do not have hope, and that we have to give them symbols of hope to keep them going. And I got the last word, compassion, from the AIDS epidemic. Having lost my lover and hundreds of my friends, it has taught me that it's not enough just to feel sorry for somebody, that you have to put that pain and that sorrow into constructive action, that you have to do something about it. I like to think, from all that pain and all that loss in my life, that I will do something about it. And for those young people who have lost their life to AIDS, that I will, for them, leave a legacy of love that America will live up to its dream and protect its most fragile members. And if we do all those things, if we completed all those things, we will have a better world.
Thank you. That was Dennis Perrone, candidate for California governor in 98, recorded at the TUC Radio Studio, San Francisco. This is Govinda Dalton. This has been a Radioactive production.
Each one reach one, each one try to teach one. Nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. Everyone must play a part. Everyone got to go to work. Work for peace. Spirit said work. Time to work.